clown with his pants falling down, or the dance that's a dream of romance, or the scene where the villain is mean. That's entertainment.
The lights on the lady in tights,
or the bride with the guy on the side,
or the ball where she gives him her all. That's entertainment.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to another True Story of Tinseltown. And I am very excited today to have as my guest John DeLeo. And he has written many, many books on Hollywood. And they have many, many books, and I can't wait to read them all because they look good. And the one we're talking about today is 10 Movies at a Time, a 350-film, wowza, journey through Hollywood in America, 1930-1970. Welcome, John.
Hey, Grace. It's really nice to be with you. Thank you for having me on.
Finally, right? Because I left you messages on your Facebook message thing. And I'm like, okay, either he never saw it or he doesn't want to come on the show. Then you finally saw it. And you said you wanted to come on the show. And I don't know, it's been like 3 months since then to this. So
we gave you some time to read the book, too. So we thought it would be more fun if, you know, instead of me describing everything, that you could sort of share in the experience and talk about the book with me.
Which I do generally 99.9% of the times read the books. So
yeah, that's great.
Yeah. Most people don't. But you know what? I want to know what I'm talking about. I don't want to sound like a Dumbo. And so your book was very good. And tell me, what gave you the idea to write it?
Well, I haven't exactly had many, many books, but this was going to be my seventh one on classic film. Seven, if you count a revised edition of my first one, which was the quiz book. So it was sort of 6.5, if you count that one. So anyway, having last worked on that revised edition, and the one before that was a compilation book. It was Screensavers 2, which was a sequel to actually more than one of the books. And that was previously unpublished material. But the one before that was Tennessee Williams and Company, which is my book about the 11 actors who appear in more than one of the Tennessee Williams movies, sort of a stock company of actors. Cool. And for me anyway, in the doing of it, was sort of an epic. And I thought I wanted, since it had been about 5 or 6 years since I'd done that one, another book of that sort of comparable ambition for me to sort of push myself, test myself. And I thought, this idea would be sort of my very personal idiosyncratic alternative history of the golden age of Hollywood, but it would be a critical history with many, many movie reviews. And I wanted to take the reader from the dawn of the talkies all the way to the dawn of the rating system and the end of the production code. So beginning in 1930, ending in 1970, and going 10 movies at a time, literally taking the chapters would each deal with 10 movies that were dealing with something that was going on in the industry, something going on in the country, reflected in the industry. And each chapter would chronologically push you further along, getting closer and closer to 1970. And so that's how it happened. And, you know, it was all sort of chapters that were interesting to me and I thought would be maybe a little quirkier than the usual stuff, meaning it wasn't just about genres, but maybe subgenres or something much more specific to the moment of whether it's a half decade or a whole decade or even sometimes just 1 year, what's going on. And the other thing with this book was, I mean, that's sort of the sort of artistic ambition reason for why I wanted to do it. Mm-hmm. The sort of practical reason was ever since I've been writing, I made a point of anytime I see a movie, I write an index card, both sides, very tiny writing, and all my impressions of any movie I watch, the facts of the plot, my impressions of the acting, what the movie did to me, where it failed, where it soared, and all of that. And they're really crammed with information. And I had over 5,000 of these at some point. And I thought, you know what? Some of my best work is in a drawer, unlikely ever to be seen by anyone. And I wonder if there would be a book idea in which I could use basically the insights, the impressions on these cards. And of course, I'd have to revisit a lot of movies as well. But this would be sort of my reference point, my own reference point. And so fusing that reality with what I said about what idea I had, it was sort of like the perfect melding of those two things. So that's my long answer to why did you write this book?
No, it's really great. I can't believe you did that to all those films and on a little card, and you had all this information.
Yeah, now we're up to 6,700 since the book was written.
Well, you have a lot more to go. What about 350? I thought that was like massive, but you have 6,700. Did you ever, because I loved your reviews, even if I don't like the genre of movie or certain actors or actors, I thought your reviews were really good. And they're not, they're very true. You're not just a gushing fan. You kind of lay it on the line. And have you ever done it for a living? You should do some reviews or something like that.
I have done it. I've never been a daily reviewer for new stuff, but I've had columns in assorted places through the years. But the thing about this kind of book in terms of reviewing that was so satisfying is that, of course, like you said, I'm writing about movies I love and movies I hate, and you're never quite sure where they're going to fall, depending on what the chapter is, what's going on in a genre. Like I said, maybe I like more than another one, too, or actors I like and don't like as much. And so I think for the reader, but also for the writer, it's much more fun when it's a mix of not knowing when you turn the page, oh, what's he going to hate this time or what's he going to gush over this time? I have no idea what's coming next. I hope that's what you get when you're going through it, because sometimes I trash movies people love very much, and I know it, and I'm not trying to be mean. I'm just trying to be honest. And sometimes I think I praise to the skies movies that probably a lot of people have never even heard of, and I hope they seek them out.
Yeah, and also, people get, it's a funny thing about classic movies, because it is a huge community. It is so popular, classic movies, TCM. Look at Facebook. Look how many pages devoted to classic movies. And there are tons of people who love them. And they take their actors and actresses and their movies really seriously. So sometimes when you put down a movie or say, I don't think this was so hot. I don't know why. Because there's a lot of movies that, everybody goes, it's a classic and I don't like. Or whatever. But, they take it seriously. Have you ever gotten any letters saying, hey, man, how could you dislike this movie? Why'd you say this about this person?
The worst of that I've ever experienced was in the Tennessee Williams book. One of the chapters is about Elizabeth Taylor, and she's a beloved figure personally.
Yes.
And I love her too. And however, regarding her work, I think she's one of those, sometimes she's great and sometimes she's bad.
Right.
And I think some of the people who are devoted to her really were not happy that I sometimes said I thought she was really bad in something. And so I think that was the most of what I guess I'd call hate mail that I got, was in terms of daring to say that Elizabeth Taylor was sometimes bad. Even though in that book, I also, as I said, praise her, quite a bit in some of her other work, just not all the time.
Right. And you were truthful. I liked it. There's some, of course, I disagreed with you, but I would never send you any death threats or any email or anything
well,
like
I appreciate that.
Never in a million years. But, I really liked it. And how long did it take you to write this?
I believe it took me 15 months to do the actual writing from the day I sat down until the day I turned it in, about 15 months. And then, of course, there's another year of getting the book out there, and there's always editing. And so you're constantly tinkering, but the basic, all day writing, all day watching, all day checking, it was basically 15 months straight through.
Not bad, because this is a very, it's a very involved book. So I've heard people have taken years and years, and I've got to say, that's pretty darn good there, Guy.
Well, I'm pretty organized. And like I said, when I picked the chapters, I kind of already knew I would have the 10 movies at a time per chapter in my head. I mean, I wasn't writing it blind. Like, I'll write this chapter and I hope I come up with 10. It was never that. It was always either I had 10 solid ones that were set to go, or I had 15 and I knew I'd knock some off as I was writing and thought, oh, this one's a little too much like that one. I don't need two that are that similar. And so it kind of, one thing I always, my experience writing about film was that each book kind of teaches you how to write it after you're about a quarter of the way in, because you kind of just have to throw yourself in and not really know where you're going. You have an outline in your head,
yeah,
a really strong one, but you're really not sure where you're going to start going. And about a quarter of the way through, you feel like the book is now telling you, you can't do this, oh, do more of that. And then you feel like you're in a groove, and then you're just sort of scheduling your time to continue this foundation that you've laid out yourself.
So you had all these 350 movies on index cards.
Yeah. And of course, like I said, many of them I had to revisit. It wasn't enough for that, because it depends how they were used in the book. Sometimes they're used in very specific chapters that when I wrote the card, I had no idea. So I had to make sure it was sort of cohesive with the theme of the chapter. But the cards weren't exact. I didn't just plug the cards into the book. They were just, like I said, my reference point for little details of impressions that I thought, oh, I loved that adjective I came up with for that performance. I'm glad I wrote it down 5 years ago, because it's going right in. And it's all from me. So you feel like it's just you a few months earlier or a few years earlier, but it's just you helping you do what you do. So.
Well, it helped. And I'm going to say, okay, so why don't we start discussing the things you chose? And it starts with our jazzy Joan, of course, Joan Crawford, silent sensation turned sound superstar. And that's 1930-32.
Yeah, so I wanted the book, obviously, to start with the transition to sound, since it was going to start in 1930, where, you know, talkies are still kind of a little shaky. Mm-hmm. And I thought it would be a good way to start the book on a positive note, instead of all those horror stories of people who went from the silence to sound only to fail right away. So I thought a great way to start would be Joan Crawford, because she became a silent star in 28 at the tail end. It's after the jazz singer, and she makes a transition that's as smooth as can be and goes from flapper to working girl of the Depression and becomes even bigger. And as I said, a sound superstar. And so the chapter is her and MGM and her costume designer, Adrian, are crafting the Crawford formula, the Crawford image, and making her the idol of millions. And how you can track it from those first 10 films, film to film, what elements are there all the time because they know they work, where they've tried to veer, sometimes it doesn't work. And so I just thought that was a good way to start it. Also starting it with a big star that everybody knows, and you don't have to say, well, Joan Crawford was this woman.
Right.
You may not have heard of her, but like I said, that was, I think in my mind, that was always going to be the way it was going to start with her.
Joan. And she did. Where did she get that culture? I mean, she was like the shop girl with that, you know, voice that was so, I wish I could cultivate it for the podcast, because I go, oh my God, my voice. Yeah. So I guess that's what they did, right? They kind of gave you voice lessons, dance lessons, all that stuff.
Yes, they all, there is certainly those elements that do carry over from era to era, where you feel like there are certain trends, and not just the way people look, but certainly the way they sound. And there is a kind of 30s voice, or even a 40s voice. I was thinking of like Margaret Sullivan and then into Lauren Bacall, that kind of voice that doesn't really exist anymore.
That husky.
Yeah, that kind of raspy and kind of throaty. And it seems like nowadays, even actresses well into their 40s still sound like they're 20, because nobody sort of develops that kind of maturity in their voice. And these women in their 20s sounded like that. And it's just styles, you know, come and go. And it is one of the pleasures, though, of old movies, voices,
particularly
because we're coming out of the silence, and the people who were able to sort of, you know, stake their claim were these voices that were so dazzling, whether it's, you know, like a Ronald Coleman or, as I said, the voices like. Yeah, like a Margaret Sullivan. That you just don't meet people who sound like that.
In real life, no. I wish I did, I do, sort of. You know why these women had those incredible voices and those husky voices? Because I was just reading. Yeah, it was Lauren Bacall's birthday yesterday, so on my on my Facebook page, she said that they said she sounded nasal and whiny. And so she was like a 4-pack a cigarette a day smoker, as for most of these people to get that husky voice and to also, you know, kind of not eat. So they smoked a lot and they got that voice. So now I think in this generation of actresses, they don't smoke. So therefore they're not going to have that husky voice.
Yeah, so of course, in the old ones, they're smoking off the set, but they're smoking on the set, too, as we all know.
Yeah, and they're puffing the cigarette right into their co-star's face. I'm like, how can they do this?
And it's also, I'm sure for a lot of them, you know, it's a wonderful prop. It's something to do with your hands. It's something to, you know, Betty Davis always said, if I didn't smoke, I wouldn't have a career. And I know what she means. It was sort of like it was built into the staging of a moment or staging of a scene, handling the props of the cigarette pack or the lighter and the cigarette case and the actual when do you puff, when do you blow, you know, all of that stuff, which is beautifully choreographed, and especially in black and white, it's very beautiful.
Yes.
And of course, you can't smell anything, so it's just beautiful.
I just looked at it. Go yeek. I want to talk about a couple of the movies that you mentioned. This one kills me. Laughing Sinners.
Yeah.
And that Neil Hamilton in that movie, in any movie in the pre-code era.
Yeah.
Yuck. You want to tell everybody about that movie a little bit?
Well, it's, she's like she often is in those early 30 movies, she's a performer. Mm-hmm. You know, ever since she made her, you know, break into stardom doing the Charleston in 28 in Our Dancing Daughters, it's funny how often the audience expected Joan Crawford to dance in most of her movies. When you think of the Mildred Pierce Joan Crawford, you think, what?
Yeah, you can't see her doing the boogie,
Yes, but she dances in this one too, and then she's a mistress, and she ends up with the Salvation Army with Clark Gable as the guy. And Neil Hamilton is the villain, but it's before Clark Gable has fully emerged, but he's showing, you know, this guy's going places, where Neil Hamilton is one of those pre-code guys, you know, is going to be gone in a few minutes, and he was. So it's interesting, that whole period of the early talkies of figuring out who's got legs and who doesn't, in terms of who's really connecting with this new version of film, the talking medium, who's clicking and who's going places and whose days are numbered. And you really see it in 30-31 when they're really giving everyone a shot. And someone like Gable is standing out, even when he's the second lead, or in Dance Fool's Dance, he's probably even lower. But with each movie, he's rising, and
more confident,
some of those guys,
and he becomes really, you know.
Yeah. And just clearly a major star, you know, nothing's going to stop him. And some of those other guys like Johnny Mac Brown and stuff, they're not going to be opposite Joan Crawford for very long. It's just not in the cards.
There's a name, and I think he died early, but he was in The First Holiday. He was in a lot of movies as like the leading man guy. And he was like a drippy poo, a Mac to the max. What was his name?
Robert Ames.
Yes.
And actually both guys, Monroe Owsley, who plays the brother.
I love him.
They were both gone in a few minutes not literally, but you know what I mean? They were gone pretty soon. But yeah, there's all those guys. There's a guy in Ladies of Leisure, which makes Barbara Stanwyck a star, Ralph Graves. And again, these are people, like I said, they were getting a shot, and you never know who's going to click. So now when you look back and you think, who is, and how did he get a leading role, or you know, with some of these people.
I guess it was because their voices weren't as terrible as some of the other guys' voices. Our Blushing Brides was a good movie. I enjoyed that one.
Yeah.
Joan was a good girl.
Yes, she's the good girl, and the other two are the cautionary tales. You know, I love when you can see the whole sort of moralistic setup of the movie, you know, how people represent something. And here are three working girls in 1930 America in a department store, and Joan does everything right and is rewarded at the end, and the other two make big mistakes. So you could go home and say, well, I'm going to be like Joan. And
she's not a good girl.
Yeah, the other two, because look how that ended. But they also give you enough sort of sex and titillation to make you feel you got some of that just by being in the room with it. But you know, nothing irreparable. You know, you go home pure.
Well, you know, Robert Montgomery was kind of a pig in this movie. At first, he's like really piggy to Joan and treating her like she's whatever, trash. And of course, he changes it. But it's so funny, as you said, his Art Deco treehouse. Would you die for that or what?
I mean, well, that's the thing. This is, of course, depression escapism, where it's so interesting because you're dealing with reality. You've got three girls doing their best just to make it. Whatever, they're not making very much a week, and they're doing whatever they can to get by. But then, within that reality that the movie is showing, there's the fantasy, and that someone like Joan Crawford, who is so beautiful, doors are going to open. And the fact that she's a model and invited to do this Oyster Bay extravaganza, the most extravagant fashion show they've probably ever had. And so you could gorge on the splendor. At the same time, you're basically seeing the idea of being people like you and me in the audience who are, you know, like I said, just trying to get by. But movies allow you to, you know, peek in the window of a world you're unlikely ever to enter. And of course, that's, in a nutshell, I guess that's the depression escapism and its lure.
Yes, it is, I'm sure. But I can't imagine. I mean, you watch this. I love those movies. I love Art Deco. You know, everybody's wearing these beautiful, lovely gowns and silk evening wear. You know, just beautiful apartments and flowers everywhere. And then I moved to New York and I, you know, it's just not the same. You moved to New York. Did you get a palatial mansion? It's just like, oh, but, you know, I was glad to be here. It just what it is. I loved Possessed. That is the first film she worked in. Was that was before she worked with Laughing Sinners, right? Possessed.
No, it's the third one with Gable.
Yeah.
It's the third one that year.
Wow.
And you can see him, his part has gotten considerably larger with each movie. And then the one after that for them, which is beyond my chapter, is Dancing Lady. And then they're equal because in between he did Red Dust. And now
I love that.
Pretty big himself.
Yeah.
But yeah. So, yeah, that chapter kind of peaks with Grand Hotel, where she's not only all the things we've talked about, but she's even gotten a little class and integrity by, you know, acting with the Barrymores. So now she's not just, you know, beautiful, exciting, vivacious Joan Crawford. She's acting with the big guns and holding her own. So that really is kind of an early peak for her.
Yeah, I never knew, because when I was younger, you know, I've loved classic movies forever, but I had never really seen young Joan without the big eyebrows, without everything.
Right.
And she was absolutely incredibly beautiful. Beautiful eyes. She was a dish. No wonder Clark and she had a little right. thing going on. Okay, can we go? You want to finish? I want to get to the second one. The Talking Breed of Superstar, 1930, and you mentioned Ladies of Leisure. And what was that basically chapter
well,
about?
Well, after I dealt with the transition from silence, then I wanted to, the next logical thing I thought to go from there were 10 people who were created by the talkies, who don't have a foot in the silence, who are brought out there, usually from the New York theater. That's usually the most obvious place that people went looking for acting talent, people who could, you know, talk, walk and talk at the same time, act with their voice. And so it's 10 people who became talking stars in 1930, 31, up to 33. So it's as you said, Barbara Stanwyck and Ladies of Leisure, and guys like Jimmy Cagney and The Public Enemy, Edward G. Robinson and Little Caesar, Boris Karloff and Frankenstein. And so many of the great icons of really the golden age of Hollywood got there right at the beginning and kind of were the prototypes for, you know, obviously Cagney and Robinson for every gangster who ever came after. And of course, Boris Karloff for every monster who came after.
Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde.
Yeah. Frederick March, you know, winning an Oscar right away and then being a major actor for several decades.
What an amazing actor.
Oh, I you know, it's funny. I didn't plan on it, but Frederick March turned out to be kind of a recurring theme in this book.
Yeah, I know.
Because I didn't really realize it until I was the movies were adding up and I kept seeing noticing how many he was in and how impressed I was by his work. And I'm always impressed by actors who get better and better. And because it's not always the case, sometimes they become a little irritating because you know their tricks and they're more obvious to you and you see them relying on them. But Frederick March was interesting because I think one of his greatest performances is in 7 Days in May in 64.
Oh, I just saw that.
Yeah, as a president.
Yes.
And he's been a star at this point 35 years and topping his work. And so natural, so real, nothing of the matinee idol that he sort of began as. And it's quite extraordinary. So, he shows up through every decade and most of the time is doing knockout work and just getting better and better and adapting with the times and adapting his style. And so I said he's a recurring theme, and I'm glad I don't think I'd written too much about him in the past. So it's nice when you make people perhaps say, yeah, I hadn't really given Frederick March much of a shake, even though he won 2 Oscars. And, but we don't talk about him as much as some of those other guys.
Yeah, because he really is great. There are so many that are not, you know, he's done everything. He's done comedy. He's done drama. He's done some of the most wonderful work, best years of our lives. His burping scene cracks me up when he burps. You know, I'm young, you know, I still laugh at burps. What can I tell you?
And not to jump around, we can go back, but one of the chapters in the 50s, it's one of my favorites, I call the Men from the Boys, and the gist of it is what did all those actors from the 30s do when Marlon Brando, Jimmy Dean, and Montgomery Clift sort of took over and became the rebels of Hollywood and changed acting in America forever, particularly in film. And, you know, the premise of it, of the chapter is, well, what would these old guys from the 30s do? Would they all run away because they were intimidated? Would they all retire or go to television? And it's the opposite answer, because guys like Frederick March and Jimmy Cagney and Jimmy Stewart, they just got better and better. And so I give you 10 examples of these 30s guys doing some of the most phenomenal work they ever did in the 1950s, right alongside Brando, not at all cowed by his presence. And so I really like that one because, again, it's a really upbeat one. And I don't think those guys get as much credit. They were hanging on, but it was more than hanging on. They were really sometimes surpassing the stuff that people loved them for. And like I said, getting better and better, which is not always easy to do.
And they were great. And I love Little Caesar because you very much say, you know, he didn't want my darling, what's his, Edward G. He was in love. You got that too, that he was in love with his best friend because he never went to the dames or anything like that. I'll never forget the scene when he's looking at himself in the mirror and his minions going, oh, boss, you look so handsome. I didn't think so, you know, and that whole thing. And that, do you think that was obvious at that time or probably not?
It's always interesting to explore that question because it comes up nowadays more and more as we're more sensitive to sexual orientations and looking back on old movies and getting vibes that you wonder, did the general audience get it? Did even the makers of the movies get it? Or were there certain codes of friendship that in people's eyes never went beyond a certain kind of relationship? And clearly sex is never involved in these situations, but is there a longing? Is there some latent thing that's stewing and brewing and causing trouble? And I think Little Caesar is a great example because, unlike Jimmy Cagney in The Public Enemy, who's quite a ladies' man and has some woman in his bedroom or on his arm in every scene, and it's kind of always rotating, Edward G. Robinson never has a date in Little Caesar.
No
and he's game. Kind of obsessed with Douglas Fairbanks Jr.
He's cute.
And
really cute.
Not hard to believe.
Hubba hubba.
But he does have that line at the end when things go wrong, referring to Douglas Fairbanks Jr. when he says something like, "This is what I get for liking a guy too much," sort of, which is a throwaway line.
Yeah.
And you could say, well, he is talking about, you know, it is his ruin, and he is, might not necessarily referring to being in love with him, but it's one of many examples where you just wonder, why isn't there some woman in the movie just so we don't think that, but often there isn't. And that's an example. Another great example is in Test Pilot, which I wrote about in another book, in which Spencer Tracy.
Another of these movies is Bill of Divorcement, which is really, I don't know if that's a very well-known flick.
Well, it's Katharine Hepburn's first movie, so it's in all the books as, you know, at least a milestone just for the fact that it introduced her. It's certainly not one of her best movies and certainly not one of her best performances, but when you see it, I think you're certainly struck with why people responded to her, because all those qualities that we're so used to in Katharine Hepburn as a movie figure, she's unlike anyone else, and her beauty's unlike anyone else, and the way she moves and certainly the way she talks is unlike anyone else. And so she has a wonderful entrance sweeping down the stairs, and it's so enrapturing. I mean, it's a very old-fashioned melodrama of insanity running in the family. But she does get to act with John Barrymore and Billy Burke, and it was directed by George Cukor, who made her his muse for many decades. So it's sort of an important film without being a particularly good one.
Yeah, and it was. And look at her career. She just went on and on and on. She kept clicking and kept on ticking. So we're on the next one. You want to say something else? Go ahead.
No, it's just something like Crawford. You have to always, to stay in the game as long as some of those people did, you constantly have to reinvent yourself. You know, hold on to the things that people like you for, but you've got to be able to tilt it in new directions, or then you'll just be a thing of the past. And it's got to be a tricky thing, but those are two examples of people who kept doing it successfully.
Yes, they did. So, okay, what are we going with here? It's Interrupted Melody, The Birth and Near Death of Movie Musicals 3033, Busby Berkeley Deluxe. How's that?
Yeah, well, you know, we think of, you know, one of the great things that happened with the talkies is, of course, the birth of a new genre, the movie musical, which couldn't exist without sound. Mm-hmm. And so we think it was smooth sailing right away because the Broadway Melody, 1929, wins the Oscars Best Picture. It's a smash hit. And then the studios went nuts, making way too many of them, most of them terrible. And then the genre was practically dead. And it doesn't really come back until 42nd Street in terms of popularity. That 1933 with 42nd Street and Flying Down to Rio, obviously, with introducing Fred and Ginger, then it takes off, you know, in a way that it will last for the next 25 years at least, with the great stars, not just Fred and Ginger, but then bringing in Judy Garland and Gene Kelly. And, you know, it's one of the great genres of mid-century Hollywood, certainly. But those early years, again, watching people figure it out, what's going to work, what doesn't. And you have a lot of terrible movie musicals. There's a couple of great ones, most notably Ruben Mamoulian's Love Me Tonight, but it's not quite the box office sensation, perhaps a little too sophisticated for what people wanted in the early Depression. But there was good work happening from him and Ernst Lubitsch. But most of the stuff, it was creaky backstage stuff with static cameras. And as you mentioned, Busby Berkeley, until he really starts flinging that camera around, there, nobody really has quite the guts to start doing that kind of thing. Where most of those numbers in those early movies feel like you have a seat in the theater of a show and you're watching a stage, a proscenium stage. And it had to loosen up for the genre really to click in film, sound film.
Yeah. I can't imagine. I remember, I'm not a really big musical fan. I have to say, that's not my favorite genre. I kind of skip. If it's something that has a good story, then I'll skip the music. Yeah. I don't know why, but it's just not my thing. Of course, I like some of them. But, you know, I'm not alone.
Well, this chapter is a sort of negative-leaning one. So what I basically give you is 10 examples of 10 failures and sort of the things they tried and the things they missed and why, because it said it was a perilous time for the movie musical. And it's just fascinating to revisit some of these things. Again, most of them are ones people never heard of because in some cases it was like they vanished without a trace. And so it's sort of fun to do the flip side of something. If you think, oh, the 30s and Fred and Ginger and Busby Berkeley, people just went nuts for musicals. And yeah, they did, but not at the beginning. And so it's just a reminder of that.
Yeah, they really just wanted, drama and...
Well, I think they were ready for the musicals. They just, Hollywood wasn't figuring out what was so good about them. And the Broadway Melody was a great start, but they weren't moving beyond it. And even that now looks like it was made about 500 years ago. It's so static and it's not particularly well performed, but it was a landmark. But those next few years, they weren't really moving beyond that, except for, like I said, Lubitsch and Mamoulian. But there were a lot of other ones made not by those two guys that were pretty bad.
Yeah, a lot of them, like you said, I had not heard of. Okay, why don't we go to Lost Generation 33, Making Peace with World War One?
Yeah, well, I'm always fascinated when you see those war movies of the early 1930s, you're struck by the anti-war feeling because, like, it's growing up watching old movies on television, we're much more likely to see World War II movies, particularly the ones in the 40s, which are so rah-rah, so morale-boosting, so we're going to beat them, don't worry, where Hollywood took its job very seriously at keeping morale high for the home front. But to see in peacetime in the early 30s, between world wars, when you have time to reflect and that sort of series of sad movies about World War One, which would never have been shown in the early 40s because it was sort of the opposite message, but sort of the grieving of the most famous one, of course, which I do include, is All Quiet on the Western Front, which is a masterpiece.
It is an amazing movie. And if any, you know, it's not just because I'm not a big war movie person because I cry because, you know, people say to me, it's just a movie. And I say, no, war happens every day. These real people died and it was horrible. Yeah. And it really shows you, you know, rah, rah, go to war, blah, blah, blah. And they're all gung ho. And Lou Ayres did a fabulous job. And it is an amazing film. It is a masterpiece. And if you do not like war films, you guys, I would advise you, if you haven't seen this movie, to definitely see it. It is so touching. And like you said, it's a masterpiece.
And I think, you know, some of those movies, too, are about after the war, like The Last Flight. And it's sort of that, like I said, that lost generation and that sort of grieving of what these people lost and sacrificed in that war. And there's an interesting one, The Eagle and the Hawk. Now, that's, again, Frederick March and a very young Cary Grant. And that one, that's a flying picture set during the war. And that's an interesting one because March is this great flyer, you know, killing Germans left and right. And he feels horrible about going into the sky every day and killing people and being congratulated for it. These movies that are now, you know, 80 plus years old. They still carry the sting because they were made from the heart. I mean, they were really trying to say something. And again, I wanted to bring to light a type of movie that happened at a particular moment. And this is pretty much over by 33, 34. And then you're already starting to gear up for what you were hearing is happening in Europe. And so you're starting to get you know, by the end, you've got Confessions of a Nazi Spy, and we're already into the next war. But for that period in the early 30s, and, you know, A Farewell to Arms is another sort of very famous, very fine one. But there was that moment where it was all about World War One, and it was predominantly anti-war.
Yeah, it was like a pacifist film. It shows you the horror, the ugliness, and yet, you know, unless you're there, you're not going to really understand what this stuff is. I've never, of course, been in war, but I just can't imagine what these poor people go through. You're killing people that you don't even know. You have nothing against them other than the fact that they're taught you're bad, so you got to kill them before they kill you. And it's just so distressing when you see things like this. So All Quiet on the Western Front, the White Sister, who was, of course, our lovely...
That's Helen Hayes.
Yes.
But, you know, sometimes, like, that's an interesting one because it's a remake of Ronald Coleman and Lillian Gish, and it's more of a soapy romantic melodrama. So I include a couple of... There was room for other things, too, like that one. But predominantly, it's the grieving. And another interesting one is Heroes for Sale with Richard Bartlett and Loretta Young.
Oh, my God.
Because basically, it's, you know, the forgotten man, the guy who distinguished himself and whose life is sort of basically one horror after another, and it's sort of, which we hear about now, too, about remembering the veterans and how quickly it does seem they are forgotten. And that movie, again, 85 years old, fell in there.
It is so relevant, and he goes in, and he has a guy, this guy who's from his hometown, and... Richard Bartholomew is really the hero. He kills somebody. Yeah. He saves people, but he's injured, and the guy thinks he's going to die, so he takes credit. But in the whole time, he's like hiding, and he was the coward. And in the meantime, he gets captured by the Germans, and he becomes addicted to morphine.
Yeah.
And that is his downfall. But he tries and tries and tries, and it shows you the bread lines, how poor people are. You know, the hobo thing, which was totally real. You know, there really were tons of
hobos. And again, this is a contemporary story. I mean, it goes up to, you know, that same thing, like I'm a Fugitive from a Chain Gang, another great one where he's a war veteran, and look where that ends. So
one of my favorites.
I wrote about that one in another book. I agree, that's one of the great movies of the early 30s, certainly. Yeah.
Best, I think it's the best performance Paul Muni ever did.
I totally agree with you. I absolutely agree.
Okay, so we're there. You got there, the White Sister, Hero for Sale. And now we're here at The Whole Town is Talking, 1930-35, neglected comedy gems of the early sound era.
Yeah, well, obviously comedy was another thing that was going to be very different in talking pictures than it was in the silent era, which was, of course, a heyday for comedy with the genius movies of Chaplin and Keaton and some others. And then it was, how do you be just as funny with words and people who can deliver dialogue, who can inflect words? And so, you know, we know we're heading by the mid-decade to the glories of screwball comedy. And but I just want to include some of those early comedies of the early 1930s that maybe aren't as famous, but that I absolutely love, and ones that show where it's going, like Frank Capra's Platinum Blonde with Gene Harlow and Robert Williams, who died right after it came out.
That was so sad. He had potential.
Yeah, he had a lot of potential. As I said, Gene Harlow and Loretta Young. And there you can see Capra sort of testing out all the things that were going to be sort of full-blown by the time he gets to It Happened One Night and Mr. Deeds Goes to Town. So that's a real charmer. And as we mentioned earlier, the original Holiday from 1930, which also in some ways it's better than the 38 version, in some ways it's not, but it's certainly worth seeing.
I think it's isn't that the guy that we're talking about?
Yeah, exactly, Robert Ames.
And
yeah.
Where he could, you know, Cary Grant makes it better, that's for sure.
Yes, Yes, in that case, that was an improvement, yes.
And that horrible woman, I don't even know her name, who he supposedly fell in love with, Cary Grant.
It's Mary Astor in the older one, and she's better than Doris Nolan in the second one. So they both have their strong points. But some of the other ones in that chapter are Million Dollar Legs, which is a hilarious farce about the Los Angeles Olympics with W.C. Fields.
I've never seen that.
It's really funny. All the way through, just laugh out loud funny. And a real gem that most people don't know is The King's Vacation with George Arliss. Because when you say George Arliss, they immediately think biopic and Disraeli and lots of sort of creaky, old-fashioned biopics that don't really tell you very much and very stagey. And he's sort of known for overacting.
Yes.
But when he's in something like a light comedy, you get to see really the charm of this guy and the wit. And this is an absolutely magical movie of a king who abdicates. And I recommend it extremely highly. And it's just a genuine gem of the early 30s.
I'm going to have to. You know what? I don't even think I heard of it, to be honest with you.
Yeah. It does play on TCM, though, but you obviously have to be on the lookout.
Yeah. Another you put, which I think is very funny, and allegedly it's based on Clara Bow's life, is Bombshell.
Yeah. It's, again, you have a contemporary portrait of MGM in 1933, and it has such energy and humor and wit that you really feel like they've captured something that actually they've captured sort of lightning in a bottle. And to have Jean Harlow playing a variation on herself, too, because she talks about doing retakes on Red Dust and Where's Clark, even though she's not playing Jean Harlow. So it's sort of her, it's sort of not her. But it's very funny, and it's a farce of the madcap life of a movie star being pushed around by the studio, by the press, by the...
being used by her family.
The press agent, the Lee Tracy, the freeloading family, Frank Morgan, her father.
He was fabulous.
Out for hand. Yeah, he's great in it. And it's just, when you see it, you feel like, I bet so much of this is, like you said, based on truth, because it just has the feeling of it. And it's a very funny movie.
What about, the part that makes me laugh the most is French O'Tone when he says, I want to run my toes through your hair. It was hysterical. He was really good in that because he never really did any comedy, but that really cracked me up. I have to say, I laughed a long time for that one.
And when she says in response to that scene, or not even Norma Shearer, Ellen Hayes, that their nicest pictures were ever spoken to like that.
I loved it.
She's never treated that way. Yes.
It's a great movie, and. If you haven't seen it, you just gotta. Okay, here we're getting to the good part. The Code Breakers, Loose Living Ladies of the Pre-Code Era, 1931-33.
Well, I think because pre-code is something that's been written about a lot, and I certainly see why. It's one of the more fascinating moments in movie history, and it was something that we didn't really get exposed to for many decades when those movies weren't allowed to be on television.
It's amazing.
Or were cut up, and then we saw scenes we'd never seen before. So it was sort of a secret time that was then unearthed, even though it wasn't really lost. It was just sort of hiding. And I thought it would be fun in that chapter to just write, obviously, about 10 movies, but to just pick one-word titles that were fairly salacious to sort of get in the spirit of the thing. And so the titles are Illicit, Forbidden, Shopworn, Unashamed, Faithless, Virtue, Flesh, Ex-Lady, Penthouse, and Female. And that sort of gives you the whole thing.
You pick some great ones, because I want to talk about Illicit is kind of a movie. And the guy who was her husband and the star of the show, he ended up being not a very big star. And he was, and I remember him in Now Voyager briefly and certain flicks here and there. But that was just like a movie.
Yeah. It was James Rennie. Yeah. He was another one of those early talky people that clearly were not going to be around.
No, you know, he didn't have that kind of oomph. But I loved it because there was Joan Blondell, whom I adore. Yes. She's always wonderful. The other one is Forbidden, when she meets that creep. She's a librarian, and she does everything. You know, she gets her on time. Her life is like blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And so she says, I'm going to get out of here. I'm going to be free. And she meets this creep, Adolf Majou.
Yes.
And ew, of all people she has to meet, really? Like Adolf Majou?
Yeah, that's another crazy one. What's interesting, too, about so many of those is that they're usually like 69 minutes or 72 minutes. Okay. And the amount of plot is like 4 hours worth of plot crammed into an hour or slightly more. And it's just crazy the amount of things that happen and the way their lives are upturned in so many directions. You just have to go with it, or even while you're saying this is crazy, but I'm having a good time.
And I'm hissing at Adolf Menju and say, Manju. Another one here I love, and this is a hoot because you wrote, you know, I've never heard this with anyone else who writes this, with shopworn and that word, but you can give us a plot of that.
Oh, she's another poor girl in love with a rich guy, Regis Toomey, and he loves her, but his scheming mother breaks them up and sends her to jail, you know, but she becomes a huge theater star. And then when they meet again, they're on equal footing, and will they find happiness? And again, she's sort of like, I guess she gets out of jail, and like in a 1 minute montage, she's like the toast of Broadway. It's kind of
weird. But
and we've never heard her mention she had any interest in the theater. So,
I know she gets into the slammer.
Crazy.
Prior to this, I just want to talk that she falls in love with Regis Toomey, who is, you know, Dripsville too.
And yeah, another one.
His mommy, who was Auntie M, is like a hypochondriac, and he's a mother's boy. I'm sorry he is, but he falls in love with her. But this is the magic word. She's trying to learn every word in the dictionary to better herself, and it is ejaculate.
Yeah. That's the thing. I mentioned it because it's just so weird in an old movie to have the word ejaculate come up.
And even like, him, he's like, oh, you don't need to learn that word. But
he reads it aloud. She wrote it down, but he reads it aloud, and you think, wow, that's pretty pre-code right there. That kind of says it.
I think probably a lot of people in the audience didn't know what ejaculate meant at that time, perhaps. I don't know.
I would imagine.
But I was like, whoa, when I saw that. And I just thought, you know, why is she after this guy and this mama's boy? And I just couldn't get that. But I did love ejaculate. You said she was ejaculate made the whole movie for me. But you said that she in the movie got pregnant. I don't remember that.
Well, it's so subtle. I can't remember. There's only one line that makes you think, oh, and I can't recall the exact same line. But you're right. They don't say, and then you didn't have the baby or the baby died. But we have to go back. But there's one line that makes me think I know you're going to say they're going to be subtle in a movie with ejaculate, but I think they were. They just had it go by. And I got the impression there was something about
when she was in the slammer and she was doing
the
work.
Slammer. Yes, yeah, something about her being under the weather. Something after that, but yeah, something that made me think that I was pretty sure that's what the implication was, without it being explicit.
How about, didn't you just love Tallulah in Faithless?
Yeah.
That is the first pre-code I ever saw. And I was like, oh, my God. Wow.
Yeah, and, you know, Tallulah always gets a bad rap for failing in talkies. And I think a lot of that was, well, none of the movies she did, I guess, were big enough hits, which is really, you know, that's the bottom line. But you can't really say she wasn't good in them, and I think Faithless is the best example. She really gives it her all.
She did.
And again, it's one of those plots. The amount of stuff that happens to one person in that short running time is ridiculous, but she really kind of carries it and connects the dots, and she's there for every scene, you know, giving it everything it's worth. And I think she gets a bad rap. It wasn't so much her fault. It was sort of the things they threw her into. And I think Faithless might be the best one of those early 30s movies that she did. But you can't fault her in it. She's terrific.
She is amazing in it. You know who I think is the worst actor that ever lived is the brother. I always knew she would be a show. She would be on the street. She is a
piece of, yeah.
You remember him? I don't think he ever did another movie again, thank God. He was the worst ever. Yeah, and so, and Robert Montgomery. And I loved her when she was, he plays a lot of parts that are funny, yet he became her, her sugar daddy. And I love that scene when she's like, she goes, "Must I pretend? You better." I want to have sex with you, honey bun. And I gave you all that stuff. And she's just distraught.
Well, what's so cool. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm done.
What also denotes it as being pre-code, of course, is the ending where your husband finds out you became a prostitute so they could afford your medicine while you're on your deathbed. And, you know, you almost expect him to be horrified that she dared to do such a thing. He would humiliate herself and get all high and mighty. But he's so grateful that she loves him that much to do that. And it's not the kind of thing you could have gotten away with once the code came in to be, thanked for entering prostitution. It just does not happen.
No, and I love that ending. Also, the cheat was very interesting. She did that one as well.
Yeah.
These pants falling down or the dance. That's a dream of romance or the scene where the villain is mean. That's entertainment.
The lights on the lady in tights.
Or the bride with the guy on the side.
Or the ball where she gives him her all. That's entertainment.
The plot can be hot, simply